Hello, everybody. Welcome back to This Weird House. I am, as always, Nick Bodick, and we have a very special guest today. Someone I cannot believe I'm talking to right now. It's still kind of sinking in. He is a, I'll get to why. He is an actor, and I don't want to give the guy's life story for him. His name is Mr. Justin Wellborn. How you doing, man?
I'm good, man. How are you?
I'm doing great. I'm doing great.
Yeah. Thanks for the introduction.
Oh, absolutely. I'm so bad with intros.
I'm not quite sure I deserve all that or that I'm, you know, worthy of that kind of, like, can't believe I'm here. Shit, man. We made time.
You find me, dude.
On Facebook. Out there, you know. Yeah.
Well, that's the thing, dude. So, like, I it's crazy that I even – so I was on one of Matt Bartlett, friend of the show, one of Matt Bartlett's posts, and you had commented something on there, and I was like, why do I recognize that name? And I have found so many people – who are authors that I know that are all friends with each other on Facebook. And I look and I'm like, no way, that's fucking Carl from Justified. And I was like, I knew that name. And then, yeah, so I mean, here we are now. And then, you know, I was going back over. So I knew you primarily for Carl from Justified and for Dante the Great from VHS Viral.
Oh, right.
Yeah. And it actually turns out that I have seen a lot of your work and just, didn't recognize, but just like, you know what I mean? Like, I didn't put it together that it was you in there. Like the Southbound, which I love, Siren. I think you were in The Bay. I didn't watch to, you know,
I was in The Bay. Yeah.
I love The Bay. I love
that.
Yeah,
I do too, man. Yeah. It's weird too, because that's the sort of movie that, like, when I went and saw it in the movie theater, I was like, oh, okay, this is really great, because I only had my scene and it was just me, and they literally handed me the camera. So now I'm doing the camera work and I'm surrounded by thousands of chickens. It's just a camera crew, me at night with doing the work of the camera crew and acting. Yeah. And thousands of chickens, which, you know, I mean, it's not the most glamorous industry all the time. Let's put it that way, man.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's actually something I wanted to talk to you about, actually. I jump around a lot on this podcast.
That's great.
I'm going to ask you a question. Man. We go off on a tangent. But one thing I did want to ask you about was found footage. I'm a huge, huge found footage fan. And you've done, like I said, VHS Viral, and you did The Bay. When it comes to doing a found footage movie, how different is it from a traditional film, I guess, put together? It's like, I'm a writer, so I'm curious about the writing. Like, is there a full script, like word for word, or is it just like, in this scene, we need to convey this information?
You know, it's strange because, my friend Dave Bruckner did the first VHS movie, and he's attached to some of the later ones too as a producer and all that, and he actually helped Greg Bishop film and co-directed in parts on Siren, and he is like one of the guys that really helped bring found footage, and like afterwards it was years of all anybody wanted were found footage movies. And you know, we'd been writing scripts and you know, he had a zillion scripts, and you know, to turn that, you mainly have a regular script. I mean, as far as I know it. And then you transfer it into the day. I mean, when you're in the day and you're like, we're going to shoot on this. And there are some shots that are going to be effect shots and you got to do certain things. But I definitely ended up holding a camera where I'm like, I'm doing somebody else's job. And I'm not sure if I'm in the frame. And, you know, now the technology's gotten a bit better and we're, you know, a lot better. And you can literally, the director can tell you on his phone if you're in frame and so forth. But, I mean, we've shot so many things where you can't even see on the monitor what we're filming until after we're done. So it does seem to be that it's more of a traditional script. There might be a little more of the camera work in the script, you know, rather than just the dialogue and so forth. But I find that really on the day we end up planning it out like choreography, as far as the found footage stuff goes, that it's much more of a strange film dance, if you will, you know, of how to actually get it done. I mean, like I said, in The Bay, I had no idea what I was filming. I knew to keep shining the light in my face And, you know, I mean, I was also in the dark, so there were these like infrared sort of lights on, so I could sort of see. And I'm shuffling around in chicken shit and chickens and all this kind of crazy stuff. And they are way, the crew was way far away. So it really was me. I was supposed to be sneaking onto this, you know, industrial farm and all this kind of stuff. And that's, you know, sort of what it felt like. And when I got back there, I was like, I cannot believe I just worked with the director from Tootsie and I got like no direction. I got fucking, you know, I mean, he's a brilliant wag the dog, you know, this great man. And he was just like, good scene, good scene. Okay, next, you know, and you're just like, I'm fucking done, you know, okay. And it is very different than, say, a Final Destination or TV show like Justified or Godless or something like that, where I mean, this you are really set up. The crew is there, you are locked in, and the camera has a lot more. I mean, the camera is the life, it is the viewer, so it has that. And it's one of the things that can both kill and really be fun about found footage movies, because too much of that shaky cam stuff, and you're just, what's going on? Where am I? You know, okay. And I remember when Blair Witch came out, and there was still the like literally standing in line for the movie, and people are like, this is supposed to be real. This is like a documentary, man. This is like going to be really, really real. And for about half of it, I was like, oh, yeah. Oh, okay. These are okay. I've got it. And then, you know, by the time you get to the great reveal at the very end, you know, you kind of see how found footage works just brilliantly. And also, originally, it was the cheaper option, especially for something like horror. Make a Western, make a horror movie. That's what filmmakers with no money can get away with. And you got to be more inventive. And so that's really, in my opinion, how found footage became so prominent, was that finally we had this swelling of young filmmakers that really just could get a hold of cheap technology and film, you know, GoPros, phones, cheaper cameras altogether, or somebody had bought a big red camera and you could borrow it, but don't fall over and break it because it's going to cost you your house. You know? So, I hope that
Man,
answered your
that's
question.
crazy. Yeah, no, it absolutely did. And then so getting a bit broader now, when did you I suppose when did you know you wanted to be an actor? And then on the other side of that, what were like your main influences as you were kind of coming to that realization?
You know, I kind of come to, I mean, honestly, this sounds the most down-home thing. I feel like I've always been an actor because I've had thousands of jobs in my life. But since I was a little kid and my mom took me to be in a play when I was 9 years old, I mean, that was the most fun. It was playing for a living. And all those jobs I've ever done, I may have liked some, I've hated lots of them and things like that, but the only thing I knew during those jobs is that I wasn't supposed to be doing that. I was supposed to be doing something else, you know? And every time I'm on set, every time I'm working in art, every time I'm in a play, every time I'm creating some kind of physical performance piece, I know I'm doing what I'm supposed to be doing. And I would say in some of these influences, I'm just going to give a shout out, like I always do, to my first agent, my mother, because she's the one that has, like, when I did the audition for Final Destination, I got a call back and I had to be in New Orleans from Atlanta in 2 days. And I was like, I don't have any money and blah, blah, blah. And I called my mom about it. And she was just like, well, if you don't go, you can't get it, right? I was like, well, that's a
Oh
good point.
man,
So I went
that's
ahead and I booked, and I came in on Ash Wednesday. So the whole city is hung over and, you know, and do this audition. And I thought it went terrible. There were all these people in the room. I could see myself on the monitor. There were people outside. I'm auditioning for The Racist. I got like a t-shirt and jeans on, and they're like skinheads and big, you know, big guys and burlap sacks and just like every rough looking person. This happens to me a lot in auditions. You go in for a bad guy, and it's like the guy from the gulag next door is, you know, auditioning, and as well as like the Hamburglar and, you know, somebody else. Yeah, man. So she was definitely the person that first introduced me to, hey, maybe he should go and play. And so I always like to give a shout out to my mom being one of my first creative influences. And then we get into stuff like, I mean, I always read mythology. I was terrified of horror movies for the longest time. I had really bad nightmares and stuff. And then it just became something that I had to get into it to get over it. And now I'm just like, please scare me. Please fucking scare, anything. Get my blood pressure up. Make me not know what's going on. That's one of the things that I, inventive horror and why I probably went to literary horror. We were briefly discussing how, like, my dad gave me my first book of H.P. Lovecraft, and recently, somewhere along the lines, I lost that book. And recently I got another copy after I saw it at Necronomicon, and I was like, I have to have it. That was the original book that, got me into that stuff. And from there, reading horror became a real thing. As you mentioned, Matthew Bartlett, he's my new, we've been friends on Facebook for a long time, but he came up to me at Necronomicon and gave me Gateways of Abomination, one of the like rare copies that he had with him. And I was so blown away by that.
Oh,
And
that's
now I want to
awesome.
just shout out, I really want to voice one of his books. I'll do it for
Oh,
free,
hell yeah.
just to get into it, man. Laird Barron was a big fan of Justified, and he found me on Facebook, and we talked for a couple years. Just like when my dog died, I literally had put some post up, and he wrote something real nice, and I told him I was on this road trip just to kind of deal with it. And he was like, "What are you reading?" And I was like, "I'm reading Blood Meridian again." He's like, "That's a dark book for a dark time. That's good." And I was like, "All right, man." And through Laird, John Langan, and recently got to meet him for the first time. And I swear, man, I'm so much more starstruck by authors who have these, like, they're going to libraries and literary stuff than I am generally movie stars or people on TV. I mean, you're kind of like you know them. You've seen them in TV all the time, but like, what did John Langan look like? I love The Fisherman. I've read all of the Wide and Carnivorous Sky. Oh my God,
Hell
I've
yeah,
got that on
dude.
Audible, and I've read it, and all this stuff. And I mean, give the guys their due. They're working hard at the thing right now, and I just love that. And they're having to do jobs that maybe they don't want to necessarily do, and life gets in the way. But at the same time, they're after it. So, literary horror helped me get into movie horror. But I'll also say that, like, some of the most haunting things were shit that they put on TV back in the 80s that, or late 70s, that you could just, like, oh, it's on ABC, 8 o'clock. Okay. And it's like, you should just see the Scar card, the Scarecrow made for TV movie. I mean, I've been dreaming about people drowning in grain ever since. I think I was like 6 or 7, So anyway, those are some of the influences, I suppose. Oh, and playing D&D, I guess. You get a wide imagination when you role play and stuff like that. Comic books, Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman.
Hell
Some
yeah.
of the bigs, Len Wein, and yeah, just so I mean, I love Mike Mignola is a big one for my current, like,
Oh,
Hellboy.
Hellboy,
It's just,
BPRD.
I mean, what a weird, wonderful story of I mean, they're just so dark at their best. They
Oh,
really,
yeah.
like, invoke a beautiful darkness inside you, and I'm just collected as much as I can get my hands on, As a matter of fact, I have to stop myself when all that stuff's on, like, TMU and, BPRD patches. I'm gonna end up looking like a January 6 person, but for, like, BPRD fucking comic books, so.
Dude. I the amount of stuff that I have almost bought, if I were to like accumulate it all right away, I would have no more room in my house. Like,
Yeah,
'cause I
yeah,
just, I
yeah,
love
yeah.
so many different franchises, so many different comics and movies and books and everything. Like, I wish I could have it all, and I wish I could have the space to have it all. And I mean, I guess
Yeah,
the money to have it all
it,
would help.
obsessions and interests rub right up against one another, and is it getting to hoarding if you're not actually reading? I've got so many books that I cannot wait to read that I have, but it's better to have too many than I've definitely met some people that are like, I have books that sit on my shelves. They look good up there. And I'm like, who are you? What do you mean?
Yeah,
Like,
I And like, I've seen people say that like collecting books is different than reading books. And like, I do understand that to an extent, but at the same time, why, like, I could get a book that I'm going to read to take up that space on the shelf. Like, I don't know why.
Although,
I don't, you know.
Yeah. I like collecting role-playing games. Like, I don't play almost any of them, you know? I mean, some of them I would love to play. I'd love to try, but getting people together or whatever. And I do read those, but generally things like, you know, older games, Call of Cthulhu. I mean, I've played that maybe twice, and I have a huge collection of old Chaosium and books because they're so cool. You know, and whatever the rules are, I just love looking at the stuff and reading about it and the little mythologies that Sandy Peterson's come up with and all that kind of stuff. So,
yeah, I'm speaking of Call of Cthulhu, I'm really trying to get into tabletop games now. Like, I've been looking, trying to find a new interest, inspiration, whatever. And tabletop games has been kind of that thing for the last few months. And Call of Cthulhu is one that I guess I found myself most interested in. And just the amount of books that they have just full of lore and basically what amounts to narrative stories and just histories and bestiaries. And it's amazing. It's incredible.
And that's the stuff I'm interested in much more than the systems. I've been playing with this Year Zero system that is just like 4 or 5 pages. It's mainly a few stats. It's all D6s and amounts of D6s. And so it makes the role-playing easier and more prevalent than the actual statistical stuff. And you kind of use your imagination a little bit more, and you can kind of fit that system into whatever world you want to. And I kind of enjoy that, you know? So,
yeah,
because you can get bogged down in the rules a whole lot, man. That's a D&D game is like, excuse me, Your Honor. On page 72 of the player's handbook, you're going to need to make a decision about this, you know. And that stuff can be fun if you win, but if you don't, you know, you get all surly.
Yeah, I can see it getting very frustrating fast. So being in as many horror films as you've been in, I'm curious about how you personally, how you convey, or I guess like your personal method for conveying like terror or fear or whatever the horror might be. Like, do you have anything that you like tap into to get that kind of what needs to be, I guess, a primal reaction to something horrifying?
I'm a big believer that the body is the body will do what the mind can't always get you there to. So you can physically get yourself to an emotional state better than I think you can work yourself up into a mental state. If you do the preparation and stuff and you kind of know what your character is about and you've done your work beforehand, and that's what I mean, like do the thinking, do the work, get there before you ever get on set as much as you can. And then when you're on set, I mean, it's kind of like stunts. It's just luck if you do it once. It's skill if you can do it again and again and again, and that's craft as far as acting goes. And you have to do it, you know? I mean, it's the same on stage. You may not be feeling it that night, but it doesn't matter. There's paid audience out there, and you need to go out there and do it. So make that happen. That's the craft of it. I believe I'm not one of those people that can, like, mentally make myself cry. Although I will cry at some maudlin' stupid commercial, you know, or whatever, you know, find myself getting worked up by something over here. Like, I don't know what psychological issue this is getting into my chest all of a sudden. But you can work that up with your breath, with your diaphragm, with your, you know, all that kind of stuff to find breath and posture and, you know, body work can get you to a more emotional state. And then again, there's also shit like, you know, am I running around in the woods at 4 a.m.? It's not hard to source terror when you're running around at, you know, you're exhausted, you're living vampire hours for week 2 or whatever it is. You're just in a state. And once you've been there for a while with the people and you know what you're doing, you know, the movie that you're making, it comes faster. You're in the spiral, you know, you're ready to go with it. So, I do like doing the work before, but I don't believe in mentally, you know, don't call me my character's role. If I need to be away, to get into a place and come into it. I've never found anybody that would not give me that space. If I needed to be quiet, you can ask for that. You know, when there have been sensitive scenes, you know, put that out there to the director and to the people that this needs to be fewer people. This needs to be quiet. We need, you know, some sacred space so that we can film this right, you know, because nobody, I've found some of the most horrible things I've ever had to do to people are to people that I really like, and that can really suck, you know? And what's weird about it is you feel so protective of those people that you're doing these horrible things to, because you don't want anything more than what is happening to them to be coming in from the outside, you know, so that they don't have to go through this again and again and again for no good reason, you know?
Do you have any particular, I guess, have you ever had any particularly like grueling shoots where you just had to do a take over and over and over and over for whatever reason there might be? Or I guess a simpler way to put it, what's the most takes you've ever had to do on a single shot?
Oh, I don't know, man. The most takes on a single shot. It's probably something small and indie, you know, it's the sort of thing like, you know, I mean, I spent 2 weeks in the stands doing Final Destination stuff, but we knew we were going to do that. So, you know, sitting in the same place and you went through your scenes and blah, blah, blah. But we had already shot all the rest of the individual stuff for the movie. So one location is one thing. And, you know, over that 2 weeks, it was fun and crazy. And we did all sorts of other stuff, but you're shooting in this one little place. Yeah, I would definitely say I've done a lot of grueling things. The worst kind of stuff is obviously when you're out in the elements, when you've been there for hours and hours and, you got there at 2 p.m. and you're not shooting until the sun goes down and you're in the desert and now it's cold and now you're, you know, those sort of things can really get to you. Or say you're shooting something and there's no air conditioning and you're just like frying. Those are definitely not pleasant conditions. I can't really tell you, man. I mean, it really has to probably be something really small, and maybe something that hasn't even come out. Because those are usually the pickiest director. They're the ones that, like, this is their one project, and they're, you know, they've thrown everything in it. Their house is mortgaged, and so they want everything right. I had a director threaten to punch me to get into an emotional state that I was like, this doesn't make any sense. And he was like, well, I'm punching the face and maybe you'll get there. And I was like, let's do that. Let's do that right now. You know? And you're like, wait a minute, we're not supposed to have a fight, like an actual fight. You know? I mean, this is stupid.
Yeah. That's wild.
Yeah. Well, I mean, things get on the line, you know, there's money involved, there are people around, you've been doing it for weeks, everybody's got different agendas. Obviously, a director's responsibilities are not what your lead actors are or any of your actors are. And, you know, you have different relationships. And at that point, that particular movie I'm talking about, I mean, the crew was living in the house that we were shooting in. So, I mean, it was... I've done tons of that kind of thing where people are living 12 to a house in the crew, and you feel bad because you've got your own room, but you know, you need that space to be able to come home at night, and these guys are sleeping on the floor and they're lucky if they have a pillow and a freaking sleeping bag, you know? So
my father-in-law's house was used as one of his friends as a filmmaker, and they used my father-in-law's house as a set for a substantial part of this guy's film. And I remember going over there, my wife and I went over there one day, and just, I mean, there's lights everywhere, and there's, I mean, I don't need to tell you what a set is like, but it was just seeing it in this house that I'd been in a million times and then seeing it transformed into this, it was crazy. Like, there's tracks running through the house. Like, I'm like, holy shit, dude.
Cable everywhere. You know what?
Yes, so many wires.
I'm now recalling, man, that I did a film where, and it was this real poor Southern thing, and the director producer guy, I had to go out to this very rural area in Georgia, and he had basically paid this family to use their children and their trailer and their little farm to shoot in all day. And it was horrific. man. I mean, like, those kids were living in terrible conditions. We had to
Oh,
have this
man.
family meal, and so there's this actress that's the mom, and we're using their real kids. The dad is passed out in some bedroom in the back, covered up by a sheet, and told not to come out, which he did later. And we're supposed to have this family dinner, like chicken and beans and all this kind of stuff. And we had to keep like pushing the kids back from the food. So I think
No
this actually
way, that's so
qualifies
sad.
because, like, I mean, they were hungry and they had not seen that kind of food, and the trailer stank, and that was rough. I'll say that that experience definitely had some shots that when it seemed to go on and on, that I'm like, I can't believe I'm here. I cannot believe where this isn't a set. This is somebody's home that these kids live in, and the mom's not there, and the dad's somewhere in the back. So yeah, I got to drive a tractor later that day, and I cannot drive a tractor. They just put me on that tractor and said, this is how to go and drive it. And I was like, okay, well, I'm sure there's no danger involved in this at all.
We'll be good. Just make it look good.
Yeah, I'm
Oh
pretty lucky I'm still here after some of the stupid things that we've done. Yeah.
So you mentioned that, like myself, horror scared you when you were younger. I'm the same way.
Yeah.
I was terrified by scary movies and everything when I was a kid. I'm curious which ones you were the most scared of. You mentioned a couple of things from like the 70s and 80s, but were there any that like really just like gave you nightmares? Like any big name character that got you, Freddy, Jason, anything like that, or just whoever?
Well, when it comes to those guys, the serial killer guys, because I was really, I mean, I was right there when, Jason and Freddy and all that. But Michael Myers was the scariest to me, for sure. I mean, that wasn't in the haunted houses and, in the movies, or he just always was. And now, of course, I realize that, like, fucking John Carpenter's the man, and that I
Oh,
love
yeah.
his movies and I love all sorts of things about him. So, that's the brilliance of those things. Weirdly, the movie that gave me the most nightmares for a while, I guess, it's just like, yeah, you just saw it too young. Dreamscape, which is
Oh,
this,
okay.
movie about psychics that can go into your dreams and all this kind of stuff. It just, that was the key that in my brain, I mean, I had nightmares, and this movie was about nightmares and being able to go into your dreams and stuff like that. But that movie really scared me, and it's not particularly necessarily a horror movie, but yeah, I was too young to see that, I think. Psycho 2, I remember that. Also, I remember like video stores, and you could just rent whatever. I mean, video stores used to have like, we'll also have pizza and candies and all sorts of stuff before Blockbuster or whatever. They were independent video stores, and you could rent anything because you were also getting like a pizza and, a rewinder machine and all sorts of stuff because your VCR didn't rewind. And so, like, I remember one night, the parents, and we had a sleepover, and we watched Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, and this was just a bunch of little kids that should not be watching this movie. There's Dennis
Of
Hopper
course
doing this
not.
fucking crazy thing, chainsaws everywhere. And I mean, we are far too young to be watching this movie. And so that one definitely gave me a chainsaw phobia for a while. But then again, right after college, I helped run a haunted house up in Seattle, and the chainsaw is, always the best way to get people out of a haunted house. And you would
Oh,
just,
yeah.
I remember the first crowds that would come through, and it'd be so quiet, just the haunted house noises and the smokes up. And I could hear them come into that last room, and I'd just be waiting right outside. And I'd hear my man Vern, crank that chainsaw, and the screaming began. And it was like music. I just love the scream. They go pouring out of the haunted house. And so after a while, when you know what the power of that motor does to people, it became a like an old friend, you begin to really enjoy it.
I have always wanted to work at a haunted house. I always thought it'd be so much fun. Just get dressed up and just scare the shit out of people for a Friday and
It's
Saturday night.
grueling work, man, and it has its own rewards, but you know, what a bunch of misfits. Haunted houses are full of fucking misfit toys and broken people, yeah, sure, and people with issues. And, you know, it can be a ton of fun, but it is long hours, very little pay. You're doing it because you love it. It's like people that do Renaissance festivals, you know, you just have to have your reasons to be there. But yeah, I would suggest doing it when you're young. Because too people late. That are sort of in the old in the haunted house stuff now, they just, it's like drugs or I don't know, something that they just need it more and more extreme, you know. I mean, the experience of getting like dunked underwater or have tarantulas poured on you, or, you know, paying for somebody to staple you. I mean, it's this close to kink, you know, where you're just
right,
I don't know, man, your circles are running very, very close.
There's that one, where is it? I think, I want to say it's somewhere in Tennessee, maybe. It's called, like, McCamey Manor, I think is what it's called. I don't know if you're familiar with that. It's, like, this, they put out, I guess, a trailer. Not really a trailer, I guess it's sort of a trailer slash advertisement for it. And it's, like, something you would see in a horror movie where, like, you have to sign this super long waiver that basically says they can do whatever you want and... Yeah, exactly. And like, this guy is sued all the time apparently, because the videos they show are just like, I mean, they're literally like stringing people up in nooses, they are shoving tarantulas into people's mouths, they're like holding people's faces underwater until they're just that close to passing out. And I'm like, who would sign up for this? Like,
a lot of people, man. I've been out to
that's what I'm saying, like, I don't
Midsummer Scream, like, and I've met people that, you know, they're basically, they paid hundreds of dollars to have these companies come and kidnap them, take them out to the desert, bury them up to their neck. They're screaming and shouting. I mean, for an experience. It's all to live in a horror movie. It's all to live this sort of fantasy, which I think is interesting, but it says a lot about your psyche. And what's wild is you'll be in line with some of these people at these horror conventions, and they're talking about these extreme experiences they've been through, and they're the most corporate goth people ever, you know. They've just got regular jobs, and that's probably why. It's their way to express this, you know, have this feeling come into them, you know. They've watched so many horror movies that you want to live in a horror movie. And you know, I do it through being in horror movies and, you know, acting and reading it and all this kind of stuff, but they want to, they want somebody to beat him up and pour cockroaches on me, you know. Okay, man, you know.
Yeah, I mean, to each their own. I don't judge. Like, it's just, it's one of those things that, like, that actually makes sense. Like, I can see if someone lives a very, I guess, at least on the surface, a very, like, straight-laced life, you know, suit and tie to work every day, 9 to 5. I can see the monotony of that, you know, really weighing on someone who does have this kind of more, I don't even want to say like counterculture, but like just this more, I guess, more extreme kind of mindset that you have to suppress while you're at the office all day.
Yeah. You would need an outlet for that
for sure.
They don't have that extreme, you know. I find sort of that, like, in all the extreme things that I've done in my both life and lifestyle and career and things like that, that, man, I crave very quiet things like painting miniatures and reading books and, you know, like a nice homemade dinner. And like, my extreme is trying to do something that feels more normal. And it feels like some people's little quiet, shy, they tend to be very shy, introverted kind of folks. And that's one of the ways that, you know, it's, I don't know, it's close to sex, it's violence, it's, you know, it's this feeling that gets your endorphins up. We were talking about, like, horror movies. Show me a horror movie that makes me feel something, makes me, they want to live that out. And I think, you know, like you said, no judgment to it, man. If you want to do it, that's great. It's just the levels of it. I much prefer a good haunted house where, you know, nobody's really going to touch you and you're not going to touch them. Yeah. And it's, you know, give me a good scare and a hop out and a chainsaw and some good stuff like that. I'm great, man. And I don't need to be bound up and stapled.
Yeah, same here. You know,
I'm definitely good on all that. And, yeah.
Yeah, right? Getting letters to your house in like December.
Right. We have your address. Okay.
Right. So you mentioned John Carpenter before. That that got me thinking about something. Actually, I'll get to that in a little bit. one other question I wanted to ask you. So if you could, and it's obviously hypothetical, if you could, however you want to look at it, either say they're making a remake or they're making this movie for the first time, if there is a horror, either villain or protagonist you could play, who would you most like to bring to life yourself?
Oh my goodness, man. You know, it's really hard to say things like movie wise because films are always getting, I'd like to play my character from Siren, Mr. Nix again. I really loved doing that movie with my friends and being able to create that character. I would love to play something that I've already done at another time. Our old movie, The Signal, which was really kind of the beginning of things. They're doing 28 years later. I'd like to do that. You know, I'd like to bring a character that I've done and he's gone through this much of his life later, and it's the Signal world, and, you know, I mean, the world of the virus, and 28 years later, we'll see if it's a good movie. You know, I mean, it has some makings of the thing. I mean, the kind of villains that I really want to play end up on stage, like Iago from Othello, or, you know, some fun things like that would be, you know, getting to play and some great Faustus, you know, Mephistopheles, that sort of thing.
Hell yeah.
Marlowe, you know, not to get too literary about it, but yeah. We were talking yesterday a little bit about Clive Barker. You know, I directed one of his plays, History of the Devil, and I would love to redirect that again. It's been 20 plus years since we did it. You know, my friend Bruckner, who I mentioned earlier, who just did the new Hellraiser movie, you know, he and I talked a lot because I knew a lot about Clive Barker and just about the worlds that he kind of creates. And Dave would tell me things that they're kind of thinking about for the movie. And, you know, yeah. Other than stage villains and plays where I would love to, you know, kind of see those things, it's a little hard to think about a particularly, like being Freddy or something like that. There are definitely other people out there that'll be able to take that and run in a different way. But, you know, anything John Carpenter did, I would literally just stand, you know, there and take the machete for it. Just to get on set with the dude and shake his hand and say thanks for the thing. And, you know, all the other.
Yeah, right.
Man, you're awesome. I saw Prince of Darkness at the church where they filmed it, and, you know, a couple years ago here awesome. In LA, and that's just the sort of things that you get to do in LA every once in a while, you know, that you're like, oh yeah, this is the actual place where Alice Cooper stabbed that guy with a bicycle, and I'm standing right there, you know, I mean, a movie set, that's this so real place cool. And so yeah, just being able to be on one of those sets and get to play with somebody that's a hero of yours doing anything would be a pretty big deal.
And that was actually something else I was going to ask, if there were any directors that you would, or actors for that matter, that you, you know, bucket list people that you'd like to work with.
You know, the industry is at such a point that I'll pretty much work with anybody at this particular point. I mean, you know, it's a weird place after COVID and the strikes and things like that. I mean, honestly, I want to get back to working with my friends. We made a lot of independent movies, and, you know, people are trying to, when the industry doesn't hire you, you start hiring yourself. And, you know, looking at my friend Zoe Cooper, who's writing on The Penguin and Teacup, and my friend Bruckner and Greg Bishop. So people I've made movies with, I want to make more movies with them, because you have a sense. I mean, Greg and I have worked together since he kind of got out of school and started getting going. And, you know, Bruckner, I directed him in theater, and we used to do theater together. And so playing with people that you have a shorthand with is delightful, you know, and that's, I think, why you see people, you know, go through Philip Seymour Hoffman working with similar directors and, you know, you find people that you have this cohesiveness with, and you want to just keep being able to play if you can. I'll say that instead of jumping in on, like, hire me for Star Wars or something like that, which, of course, would be a delightful thing. But, you know, I'm trying to – you got to be realistic about these things, you know. And there's something rewarding about the work that you do with somebody that you care about. And when it comes out, it's much more personal, you know, than necessarily some of the bigger stuff that you've done, you know,
Yeah,
or that you get
that
to
makes
do.
sense, for sure. So the initial, what I know you most from is Justified, and you played Carl, and Carl was one of my favorite characters from the show for, and I promise you, I'm not just saying that because I'm talking to the guy who brought him to life. I really did enjoy Carl so much those last, I think you're in 3 seasons of the show,
Oh
and
no, please.
I was curious, and the Justified has been off the air for years, so there will probably be spoilers. People deal with it if they, you know. I'm curious, did you have a backstory for Carl? Because, like with many of Boyd Crowder's, I guess, henchmen, his partner, whatever you want to call them, they're just kind of there one day. And I'm curious if you, in your bringing the character to life, kind of gave him your own backstory.
I did, mainly because the season. So I got on season 5, and there's 6 seasons. So
Oh,
I had
I thought you were in
auditioned
four as
a
well.
bunch during season 4, and I kept. They were like one day guest star bits, you know. And I was, you know, actor in Hollywood. I hadn't been here too long, but we had been really aiming at the show, and like you'd be really great for this. And the casting director liked me, and I didn't really understand. I kept auditioning for it and not getting these like one day roles that you'd probably be perfect at. And other guys that sort of looked like me, but were also, you know, Hollywood bad guy kind of dudes, they kept getting the roles, and I was a little disheartened by it. And then they called me up before season 5, and they were like, "We would like you to be on the show, and we want you to be in Crowder's gang, because we killed almost everybody in season 4 except for Jesse, and we'll bring you in." And what's awesome is they had kept me in mind, they kept me in pocket, as they say, and so they had saved me. They liked me
Oh,
enough that they
that's
were like, "We don't
awesome.
know what we want to do with this guy, but like, and now here's this opportunity. We killed off all these bad guys. We need somebody to come in." And I knew that Boyd had been in the army, and so or at least had ties with that, and also the, you know, the military is this way that you're able to escape poverty at least temporarily. And I had always seen Carl as he had been in the military, he had been over in Iraq and Afghanistan, or, you know, one or the other. And that through those connections, and that was, I think he and Boyd had similar friends and smuggling buddies and things like that. And probably some familiar family ties, because that's how Harlan is, you know, in the Justified worlds, that everybody's kind of interconnected. And so yeah, I had kind of seen it that he had been working adjacent to Boyd and Boyd's people for a long time, and that when Boyd's gang went down and he decided to kind of go gangster and take on these other mobs and things like that, that Carl came in with sniper abilities and, you know, ruthlessness. I mean, that was one of the things I liked about him, is that he was ruthless. He still had somewhat of a sense of humor, and he had a tight head about him. I mean, when the two crows come in and they're, you know, threatening him, he makes no bones about dropping everything and starting to, you know, go at him. No fear, no way, you know, walking into these dire situations. And I always say that, I mean, his downfall is loyalty. He actually has a line when he's in jail that, you know, there can be, you know, somebody says there's no honor among thieves. And he's like, "Well, there can be if everybody stops stealing from one another," you know, that there's actually a weird ethos under there. And when he eventually comes and, you know, comes to Boyd, and, you know, there's going to be a reckoning, I mean, it's his own loyalty that's his own downfall, you know. And so while being a henchman, I mean, I was kind of amazed. I mean, you're a bad guy and Justified. I figured I had a 3 or 4 episode lifespan before it's going to go. And then suddenly I'm there for season 6. And, you know, I mean, I made it through 20 episodes worth of, you know, 2 seasons. That's pretty good longevity. I mean, somebody in the writer room and the, you know, they generally like you, that they want to give you something. And, that was a real privilege, to be there and to get to go to work on this set full of people that knew what they were doing and were really excited to be there and wanted it to be the best entertainment product that they could create. And so I took it real seriously. And so there was history in my mind. And in the sixth season, they even gave me like a brother. And so all of a sudden there were more, I had a last name all of a sudden. And, you know, so there was a lot more to build on than in the first season that I knew that I had this sort of personal backstory, but all of a sudden we're, you know, shifting into some actual familial ties. And so it kind of filled out. The longer I was there, the more I was able to give to it. Although I will say that on my first night of shooting, and it was really great because, you know, there are people there that I'd seen from other sets. And, you know, there's Walton Goggins and I'm meeting him for the first time. And I've got to do this thing where I walk up and I've got a gun and I stand behind him along with my friend Jesse Lucan. Who's the only living henchman still, you know, there. And the door of this truck opens up. We're supposed to just start blasting away at the thing. And the guys handed me like a gun. They were like, you know how to use this, right? And I was like, you're lucky I do, because I'm like shooting just this side of Walton Goggins' head. And this is all blanks. And after all this stuff with rust and all, you know, you really being aware of what to ask and who's handing you things. And, you know, I mean, I'm real glad I did know what I'm doing and had real personal history with weapons, because Walt's head was right here next to, you know, where you're shooting away from. So, he might not have gone on to such great activities had I, been a little bit more of a bumbler. So I always liked working from the idea that Carl knew what he was doing while so many of Boyd's other henchmen were kind of idiots. And I think that's one of the reasons that he had a sharp, intuitive, logical, mistrusting, cynical, criminal air to it. And it was natural for him to be in that environment. You know, I like to look at it sort of like the Renaissance Borgias. You know, you hire an assassin because you know he can do and he can collect and he can do whatever the bag man jobs are. That's how I kind of looked at him. He was a bag man. He could, you know, pick up, put down, take care of whatever it was that you needed to do. And I really liked that about him, you know?
Yeah, that was something that jumped out about the character to me, because obviously Boyd is... I saw an interview with Walton Goggins very recently, actually, where he was saying he initially wasn't interested in taking on the character of Boyd because he didn't want to be, you know, perpetuating stereotypes of, you know, people of from where he's from and where he grew up and people he knew. And he said he would only play Boyd if Boyd could always be the actual smartest person in the room.
Yeah, and totally.
Like,
totally.
And that shows for sure, because, I mean, Boyd Crowder is a, like, I would say a bona fide genius just in the way that he operates. Like, it's incredible watching that character. He is my personal favorite television villain of all time and the most likable television
villain. I'm right there with you, man. And he was like that to work with. I mean, Walt feels like one of the smartest guys in the room when you're kind of there intuitively, not because he's, you know, particularly saying anything intelligent, which he does, or is emotionally aware, which he is. It's just a feeling you get when you're able to do the scenes. He taught me a lot. He taught me so much about what it is to be on a show, because he had been on The Shield and you know, he'd been on Justified for a long time. And in the pilot, you know, I mean, Walton is this racist, preaching maniac, and he gets killed. But they end up, you know, retroing it because they liked him so much. And I think that's why Walt probably loved doing the pilot. He was able to give everything. And then he comes back and he retros the whole character into going, I was actually doing that because it's a ploy to keep power, to keep these guys on my side. And while he had to wear that, like, permanent tattoo swastika thing, you know, that he had, it was all a prison act. You know, and as the show comes around, you realize that he's playing that stuff again. I mean, in the new series, they brought Walton back, you know. Oh, I mean, I know. He finally goes to this character that's, you know, a weirdly emotively aware, you know, this bad guy that is, you know, has passions and thoughts and plans. And he's always kind of in between being a real bad guy and the bad guys he's up against. Like, he's a bad guy with honor, and it's at the end that he really goes full on, as he says, Jesse James. And he just is blasting his way through people that are loyal and not. just to get to the heart of the situation. You know, he's willing to go as far as far will, you know? And yeah, I love and that the series ends with a line, with the last line from Fire in the Hole. And, you know, when you get Elmore Leonard directly into again, I mean, it was just such a great nod. You know, we dug coal together. You know, there's just something like, oh, there it was. And I while I'm just glad that they brought about back, it again. You know, like, what is it? Justified City Primeval. I mean, that's a great name. But it was kind of great where it left. You know, I'm glad they went on. Yeah. I'm glad everybody got a job again. I'm glad everybody gets to play in the world again. That's awesome.
Yeah.
I understand why they do it. But it was such a great, just like, sign off, you know? And they really did on purpose. They ended the show because they were like, let's go out on a high note. Let's go out on our decision rather than run this thing into the ground. And, you know,
Which they very easily could have.
100% They could have gone season after season for a while, but people wanted to do some other stuff, you know? I mean, Walton had just gotten Hateful Eight, and we were we were shooting two episodes at a time right at Christmas time so that, and everybody was doing the work because they wanted Walton to go on that Tarantino movie. They wanted to help him get there. Yeah, man. I mean, he's that kind of person. Tim's that kind of person too, you know? I mean, it really does begin to feel like a family or a tight-knit group of people that really make it happen. So
yeah, that's so awesome. Yeah, you mentioned that right towards the end of the series when Boyd really kind of goes off the rails, and I always thought that when your character, spoilers, Carl dies is when the true downhill starts. That was the first irredeemable thing he did.
That's exactly right. I feel like that too. So, I mean, look, dude, Unjustified, you're always expecting. You don't know when you're going to pick up a script. I was sitting there with friends of mine when they got the next script, and they're like, oh, shit, I die. I'm off the show. And they were so sad. And I totally understand that. But I knew we were rounding it up, and I was like, this is probably going to end in a one-on-one. So somewhere you're either going to jail or you're, you know, you're going to go out, man. This is the end of the season. This is awesome. But I agree that act against somebody who is absolutely willing to believe you and follow you and all of that is his downhill irredeemable act, as you said. That really is like, all right, dude, now I can't like you anymore. I can like you as a character watching you, but I can't sympathize with you anymore. Could you just straight up murder this guy that is like your very loyal, ongoing.
Yeah.
He even thinks of you as like friend, you know, boss.
Yeah. Yeah, more beyond, just boss, more than business partner. Like, he actually considers, that's what I was going to say. I was like, that's when they really started making Boyd just a villain, an outright villain, and someone you didn't even love to hate or hate to love, whatever it may be. And then I was going to say the second thing that he does, which is just makes, it's the cherry on top of the horrible cake that was Carl's death, is when Shea Whigham is on there and he kills Shea Whigham.
Yeah.
And like, that was just so, like, that was the person. Shea Whigham's character was a microcosm of the people that Boyd Crowder exists for.
Yeah.
And I was like, you just fucking just shot this guy down.
And he
like,
becomes more
that was him
more
going against everything he believed in.
Yeah, man. And because he actually did have this ethos, and I mean, Carl goes to the hospital to kill him because of betrayal. This is not, this is emotional. I mean, he knows that he'll go to jail. This is a suicide run or whatever, you know, like this is not going to be good. But Boyd deserves it. He betrayed you. You know, he was going to hand you over to the police, and my brother's in jail, and, you know, this is, fuck you, dude. You know, that's it. And then he makes the mistake of listening and accepting and trusting. And that's what it is, you know? And that was kind of wonderful to play too, because I felt like I got to be in, you know, to really round out what I had felt about the character rather than just kind of die some anonymous death, that it meant something.
Yeah.
And it meant something in the service to the show, to the characters that, I mean, and if you're in Hamlet and you're Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, you're not Hamlet. You're there to serve Hamlet in the play. You can do all sorts of neat stuff, but if you are, you know, bigger than Hamlet is, you know, you should be interesting. Mercutio can be fantastic on stage, but he is there in the play as service to Romeo in the greater story. You know, it has to happen that way. Not to keep coming back to Shakespeare, but these big archetypes are the great ones to call from because they're the big stories. And being in service to the greater story is what you're there for as an actor in that. You know, get your character highlight moments, but I knew where we were going and you can just play it backwards, you know, at least in that episode. Give him everything so that the audience feels that pain when he murders you. And so when he walks down the hall, you're just like, okay, it's on. Two more episodes. This is going to go bad. This is going to be bad. Yep. Yeah. So.
Yeah. And it came through, dude. Like, God, I love that show so much. And you in it.
Thanks, man. Keep watching. Because I still get residuals from that. So audience, keep watching Justified, the original series. It's very good. It is very good.
My buddy and I watch it at least once a year, and we text about it the entire time we watch it. We always watch it simultaneously. I love that show so much.
You know, I haven't seen it in forever, man. I should watch it again. I mean, by the time it gets, it's funny because I knew Tim because I'd done The Crazies with him, and he had just gotten off Deadwood, which was one of my favorite shows. And the first season of Justified is like a Deadwood reunion. And I'm really, really lucky I was on the show. And that first season, they pretty much used up all of the friends from Deadwood in single episodes. So all these great actors like Earl Brown and Sean Bridgers and all these guys, they got one episode. And luckily they were able to get that season, you know, off, because season two of Justified is amazing. They were able to kill off a lot of those guys from that big HBO show and get them off the air so they couldn't reuse them. So I think all the gods that Deadwood had and they've been able to pull all that for that first season. And the first season they shot completely in pretty much, I think it was before they got to Santa Clarita, so they were still filming a lot in L.A. There's even an episode that takes place in L.A. I mean, they're pulling out whatever stops they can to keep that show, you know, going.
Yeah.
And then we moved up to Santa Clarita and Green Valley and had some really good outdoor sets and things like that that we were able to play with for the rest of the show, so.
Nice. Hell yeah. I know we are right down the wire here.
We've got a bit more time, man. Yeah. No worries. Okay.
And it's weird to go from Justified to this, but you were on, and forgive me, I didn't do the actual, like, I didn't watch the full episode or anything. You were on iCarly at one point. And I know, weird transition, right?
No, awesome, dude. Yeah. No.
And I'm just curious. I've never been able to put my finger on it, but there's such a different feel to when you watch a show like iCarly versus a show like Justified or literally any non-Disney, non-Nickelodeon show. I don't know what the difference is, but it comes through in like the cinematography, the direction. And I noticed it. I did watch a clip of you in iCarly and I notice, and it's not just you, it's every actor I've seen who I have seen elsewhere on a show like iCarly. What is different about acting in a show like iCarly versus something else? Because I feel like you, Justin Welborn, as an actor, have your own style and your own method of getting into a character, but it always seems so different on a show like iCarly. So I guess, is there any difference to the way you approach a show like that?
Yeah. For one, iCarly is a big, broad show. So it was almost like acting in a play. And I get to play this big character, Jimmy the Shady Guy. Yeah. You know, I mean, and in Justified, you're actually trying to portray somebody that is human and has, you know, while a bigger world is going on, you know, you're trying to still base it in a sense of reality. While iCarly, I mean, they're literal like bump jokes, and the set, there's like this set and this, and they're right next to one another. So it's almost like, and they tend to like go, they're filming this one, then they take the camera down that way and then this way. And so you're filming kind of on these, this weird set reel. You know, I get there and it's the Pawn Star guys are in that episode because they were bringing in, you know, whatever guest stars. I never even watched the show. But I knew it was, you know, I watched some clips of it and it was kind of this big, broad, you know, Disney comedy, Nickelodeon. And I had never done any stuff like that, but it's also like I had absolutely done big, broad comedy on stage and, you know, I've been acting since I was a kid and I got my degree in it. So you've done all sorts of commedia dell'arte and you know how to do the beats and how to keep your body. And what's really weird is, A, on that show, except for the shirt, all those are my clothes, which is hilarious. That you're like, man, basically, you know, I mean, I went to audition for that thing and it's just like I was talking about before. It was for Jimmy the Shady Guy. And I literally didn't even have a car at the time here in LA. I bicycle up to the studio and the security guard at the office goes, Jimmy the Shady Guy. And I was like, shut up. I'm here to audition. And like, you just... Yeah, I'm here for that. And you go in and everybody up there looks like a prisoner that has escaped, or they look like, you know, somebody that shouldn't be on a Nickelodeon set at all. And so I was the shadiest but acceptable shadiest guy that they could get for that role that, you know, wasn't going to frighten the other actresses and things. And so I felt great. I mean, I got that job and, you know, popped it out in the week and it was a lot of fun. It's funny. I get more, Facebook messages from, women that I went to high school with because their kids have just watched iCarly and they're like, oh my God, there you are. Blah, blah, blah. They may have never seen any of my horror movies, but they always hit me up about iCarly, that particular episode. So yeah,
that's awesome, dude.
Big, that's broad, great. Fun, weird, comedy, didn't pay a whole lot, but you know, exposure wise it was a lot of fun, and it was such a departure from what I normally get to do, so you know. And that's always a treat as an actor, because yes, I play a lot of these kind of parts, but I'm always interested in playing other things as well, you know. That's always in your DNA, is wanting to do something that you don't normally get to do, which is I think is why you get like Brad Pitt to show up in, you know, a Deadpool movie for just a brief moment, and or this Lost City movie where he plays this guy and then gets his head blown off. That's the joy. It's a joy. Yeah. You know, you're like, I'm going to be in this thing. And then suddenly you're just horribly dead. You know, that's awesome. Bullet Train for him is another really good one where you're like, oh, you got to do all this stuff. Your stunt guy directed this. And because y'all been working together forever, you decided to, like, what a great joy to get to play with people that are your family. You want to support them, and you get to play this neurotic hitman that doesn't want to do anything with guns. You know, I mean,
right, a pacifist hitman. Yeah,
exactly. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's so much fun and a great stretch from what you normally get to play in being pretty or, you know, the serious, you know, actor.
Hell yeah, man. Well, Justin, thank you so much, man. I really appreciate you coming on and joining me for this. If anybody wants to, I guess, interact with you, if they want to check out your stuff, where can they do so?
You can find me on Facebook. I'm not going to give you my phone number unless, you know, you're cute or you're promising money or something like that. I'm on the internet as it is. Facebook's a good one. I'm on Instagram through Right Club LA. If anybody, you know, comes around that anymore. I've been doing a lot of less social media just in general. It's been really good to kind of get away from it a lot and pay attention to or escape in books and away from news and just doing things like that. So I'm findable. You know, if anybody else out there that is in the horror community wants to talk, wants to podcast or chit chat or play a game or some stuff like that, I'm all into it, man. Especially some of these. I'm really glad that you were able to talk with some of these great writers that for so long I just admire the hell out of it. You know, Laird and John and Matthew, and we were talking about Nathan Ballingrub and Brian Evanson, and, you know, just so many great writers that to inspire these things. And sometimes it's just going to live in a book. And it's really amazing when we get to have similar friends like that. I'm glad they hooked us up, man. So
Hell yeah, man. Same here. Well, Justin, you take care, man. I will. Yeah, you have a good Thanksgiving, and I will definitely
talk to you
soon.
That's tomorrow. That's right.
Hell yeah.
I'm going to go run through some errands. Have a great day, man. Very nice to meet everybody. All right. Later.